From WUOT News, this is The Method, a series exploring the intersection of science and society. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Today we focus on just one topic, the space program. It was 4 years ago this month that the space shuttle was retired, and it will be years before NASA's next-generation spacecraft, called Orion, is ready to send astronauts into Earth orbit or even further. I thought it would be a good time to find out what we can learn from the space program's triumphs and tragedies. Later in this program, a conversation with author Margaret Lazarus Dean about why the space program lost its luster. But first, when bridges fall down, when planes crash, or when buildings collapse, people want to know why. Engineers become forensic scientists, piecing together the story of what happened using the evidence left behind. That same process unfolded after the space shuttle Columbia burned up in the Earth's atmosphere upon reentry in 2003. Earlier this month, pieces of Columbia were brought to Oak Ridge, so high school students attending a material science workshop could closely examine them.
What you're looking for are surface anomalies?
This is Steve Dekanich. He's a metallurgist at the Y-12 National Security Complex. He studies the characteristics of metal and related materials.
In essence, the pattern that is on the surface can tell you the mode of failure that a part went through.
The students at the materials science workshop used microscopes and other tools to closely examine the pieces of Columbia.
They were exposed to a scanning electron microscope. They were also exposed to a state-of-the-art optical microscope that could do digital imaging and 3D renderings. And they also had access to a complete mobile metallography laboratory.
NASA's Steve McDaniel says that's a big shift from the 1986 Challenger disaster, in which pieces of the shuttle orbiter were locked away in an underground vault near the Kennedy Space Center.
With the Columbia, one thing that NASA has done was, instead of just taking the debris and then storing it, in this case, they decided to have it available for research, education, things like that.
McDaniel says it's hoped that letting engineers and students look at Columbia's remains will help them better understand structural failures and hopefully prevent a repeat tragedy. And the results aren't useful just within the space program, says Y-12's Steve Dekanich.
Anything that you have out there, whether it's automobiles, whether it is computer chip, bridges, aircraft, it all deals with material science.
Columbia's final flight in 2003 was dedicated to scientific research. It carried experiments that looked at the Earth's atmosphere, biology, navigation, and solar physics. It's interesting, then, to think that Columbia's scientific mission, at least in some respect, continues even 12 years after the shuttle's loss. As I mentioned at the top of the show, this month marks the fourth anniversary of the space shuttle's final mission. But the energy that supported America's earliest steps into space ebbed long before the summer of 2011. In her new book, Leaving Orbit, Notes from the Last Days of American Spaceflight, Margaret Lazarus Dean writes about the end of the shuttle program and how it affected the people who worked for NASA and the people who love manned spaceflight. Dean says the shuttle never really grabbed the public's attention the way Mercury or Apollo did in the 60s, in part because it was created as public and political interest in space was on the wane.
It was NASA's intention to use a shuttle to build an orbiting space station. An orbiting space station is the best place to build a large interplanetary spacecraft, and then to use that spacecraft to get to Mars. And the shuttle was only just the first piece of this large, ambitious plan. And Congress and budgetary constraints being what they are, NASA got bargained down to just the shuttle eventually. I think in a lot of ways it's unfair to blame the shuttle for being boring when it did what it was asked to do. It went into space over and over again. But at the same time, I think it's still a beautiful spacecraft, and I think the things that it did were awe-inspiring and were worthy of poetry.
In this book, Leaving Orbit, you give a lot of attention to Cape Canaveral, which, of course, is the place where all these missions began. The American manned spaceflight program had only one spaceport, and it was at the Kennedy Space Center. And the buildings and the launch pads that are there seem to stand as a reminder of what NASA thought or anticipated its future in space would be. And, for example, a really good example, the big vehicle assembly building, which is huge. It's 30 feet shorter than the Washington Monument and much larger in terms of its aerial footprint. It was built to house up to 4 Saturn V boosters at a time because NASA thought, hey, we might be sending Apollo missions to the moon all the time. We'll need space for 4 of these massive boosters. But that never really materialized. What is it like going there to the Kennedy Space Center and seeing these great structures that never really lived up to the ambitions that built them?
Yeah, most of the structures of the Kennedy Space Center were built very quickly in 1965 and 1966. And it is a bit like going into a time machine. Everything is from a very specific moment, and everything was designed with, as you say, this kind of ambitious, optimistic idea in mind. But at the same time, as you say, the program has never quite gotten to live up to what it could have been. NASA has always been kind of caught in this double bind. You know, we ask them to dream for us. We put them in charge of dreaming our dreams as Americans. But then when it comes to actually paying for things, we tell them, well, why don't you just do about 1/10 of that? Or why don't you do just about 1/20 of that?
As a child, you used to spend weekends at the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., which I think is just marvelous. They had the Apollo 11 command module on display at the Air and Space Museum. And even just 10 years down the road after 1969, you write that you felt like it already felt antiquated. It already felt outdated. You couldn't even believe that people went to the moon in something that looked like this thing. I wanted to ask if you've seen any of the shuttles now that they've been retired and have joined the Apollo, Mercury, and Gemini capsules as historic pieces, museum relics.
It is interesting to think that these spacecraft that I personally got to see fly, I saw all 3 of them launch at one time or another, are now kind of joining the jumble of stuff in a museum. I was there when Discovery was put into the Air and Space Museum. When Discovery was rolled in, the wall closed behind it, and sort of the crowd settled, the dust settled, and we could see that just in front of Discovery was also visible one of the Mercury capsules, which was space flown. And in a way, it was nice to see these things kind of taking up residence together. But as you say, at the same time, it's a little disturbing to think this is now just a relic, like this Mercury capsule, which will never go to space again. What are we replacing it with? What is the next thing going to be?
Margaret Lazarus Dean is an associate professor in the Department of English here at the University of Tennessee. Her newest book is called Leaving Orbit. It's about the end of the space shuttle program and its cultural effects. Margaret, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That does it for this edition of The Method. Our past shows can be found online at WUOT.org. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth.